Most of us fear making mistakes, but if you think about it, mistakes can have a good side. There's not much we can learn from a steady diet of success, and experimentation, risk-taking, and discovery all involve wrong turns on the way to the right road. Alina Tugend, who writes the Shortcuts column for the New York Times, calls her new book Better by Mistake, The Unexpected Benefits of Being Wrong. It's published by Riverhead, and I'm very pleased that it brings her to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Pleasure to be here.
So how'd you get interested in this subject? Are you one of those people who is a bit of a perfectionist?
I never really thought of myself that way, but I am someone who hates to make mistakes. And I got interested when I made a mistake in one of my columns. And I owned up to it. I corrected it, despite the fact I initially tried to figure out a way not to own up to it. And it got me thinking, why do I hate mistakes so much?
Well, if you work in a newspaper, you hate mistakes because the readers are always catching you. And I'm assuming that if you make too many mistakes at the New York Times, they let you go.
Yeah, that's right. And you're right. Readers love catching my mistakes. And they do let you go.
Not just yours. Don't take it personally.
You're right.
It's the New York Times.
You're right. You're right. Absolutely. I shouldn't take it personally.
It's the paper of record.
See, there you go. I'm taking it personally again. But the thing is, I don't make that many mistakes, but I do because we're all human. And I realized how much I hate it. And it got me thinking about why, when we're young, we learn this idea that we learn from our mistakes. And as we get older, we really don't believe that.
But is there a difference between an error and a mistake?
I mean, technically, yes, we could say an error is a smaller mistake. It's more a slip or a lapse. A mistake is bigger. It might have bigger consequences.
An error might be misspelling somebody's name or getting the wrong date.
That's correct.
A mistake is saying Alina Tugend did this because she hated her father.
Exactly. And my mistake or error was not substantive, but it bothered me enough and it bothered me to have to run a correction.
You tell an anecdote from a friend when she asked her son what he had learned in kindergarten that day. He replied, "Nothing. My teacher said you learned by making mistakes and I didn't make any today."
That's right. And I heard that even before I started thinking about writing about mistakes. But it was such a great illustration of how we change as we get older, that none of us go to bed at night and think, wow, I made some great mistakes, or very few of us. Most of us, if we think about them, sort of think about, you know, feel badly about them.
You talk about the work of the psychologist Carol Dweck and what she called the inverse power of praise. What were her experiments?
She's done groundbreaking research on how children learn to avoid or accept mistakes. One example I use, and I observed when I went to Palo Alto, was she took 400 fifth graders and she had them do a test. And it was an easy test, so most of them did well. Half were praised for being really smart. You did great on that test. You're so smart. And half were praised for making a really good effort. Then they were offered another test. They could either take one that was easy and they'd do really well, or one that was difficult and they would probably be challenged but maybe make mistakes. Almost all of those praised for being really smart chose the easy test because they didn't want to look dumb. And almost all of those praised for making a great effort chose the challenging test.
Well, that's wonderful, except that you learn in college that if you take all of those difficult philosophy courses that you're not likely to get an A in unless you're a philosophy major, that when you want to get into grad school, that's going to work against you, whereas those kids who took all the easy classes are going to be running straight A's and are likely to get into the best schools.
I mean, that's true to some extent. And yes, we do love results in this culture. We do love the good grades and the good test scores and later on the big bonuses and the big houses. But I'll tell you, my son's in high school and it does make a difference. The colleges do look, are you taking the harder courses? And maybe you didn't do quite as well as if you took the easy courses, but they do take that into consideration.
You cite various differences between Chinese and American attitudes. In China, student test scores are publicly posted, but in this country, it's done once in a while, but educators are generally reluctant to do something like that.
Yeah, and I also talk about Japan. Both of them have much more community-oriented cultures. We have more individualistic. We tend to view if we view someone else doing better and we do worse, if someone's talking about it, we see it as bragging. In China or Japan, that's more often seen as a way a classmate or a peer is helping someone do better. So it's culturally, we view those things in a different way.
So they see it as a motivating force?
That's correct.
And we see it as a humiliation if we didn't get the A.
That's exactly right.
You describe two math classes with teachers you call Miss Rosina and Miss Barsano. Did you make up those names?
No, that was part of a research paper.
What was the difference between their methods?
One was much more willing to let the child work through the mistakes. He got up there, he was doing a math problem. She allowed him to go through it. She asked the class what he thought. She created a community of learners. The other one, when the child was wrong, she immediately said, "That's okay. Good try. You were almost right, but why don't you go sit down?" She almost hushed up the mistake. She was well-intentioned, but the result is she didn't help the child learn, and she made the child feel like doing something wrong was a humiliation.
Well, my high school math teacher, Miss Garretson, when she asked me for the answer and I said, you know, X over 33, she'd say, correct answer, Mr. Markowitz. Should be. So I never wanted to raise my hand.
Well, that's part of the trouble. And this one, you spoke about comparing Chinese or Japanese. There have been a lot of studies between North Americans and the Japanese, and how in Japan, in early education at least, there's much more willingness to take those mistakes and look at them and not do what your teacher did, which is make it sound like you just screwed up. Because as someone said, in every wrong answer, there's a partially correct answer.
But in those days, nobody worried about self-esteem. Does criticism damage people's self-esteem?
Well, I mean, this is something that's debated, but more and more child development experts feel that you don't give children self-esteem by praising them and by just saying you're great, you're a star, and handing out a trophy. Self-esteem comes from resilience, and part of that resilience is knowing you can make mistakes, knowing you can fail, and knowing that you can come back again.
Now, there are some areas where we don't like to see failure, like the medical field. How are they handled there?
I mean, as we know, there's a lot of errors in the medical field, and mostly it's not because of some rogue doctor cutting off the wrong leg. It tends to be systemic. There's a lot of infections often are a large reason for this problem. And one of the ways they've handled this, and they've looked at this, and one of the ways they've looked at, they've taken aviation as an example that's worked very well in terms of handling errors and brought it to medicine. One of them is checklists. I know you've talked about that in this program.
With Atul Gawande, who's a physician and a writer for The New Yorker.
Exactly.
Wrote a wonderful book on checklists.
He did, and I used that. And I also went to Peter Provenost, who's a doctor at Johns Hopkins, and who Atul Gawande quotes, as he's one of the people who started this in surgical ICUs, how to use checklists, very simple checklists, such as, doctor, you washed your hands. Doctor, did you put the surgical drapings on the patient? And how those checklists, plus allowing a culture where nurses could challenge doctors and say you didn't do it right, how they really reduced infections enormously.
Well, if a doctor is going to learn from his mistakes, I would prefer that it be on some other patient.
I would too. But the point is, part of this is error prevention as well. It's not just doing a mistake and then seeing what happened.
My guest is Alina Tugend, T-U-G-E-N-D. Her book, Better by Mistake, The Unexpected Benefits of Being Wrong. It's published by Riverhead Books. Well, you mentioned the airlines. We've been hearing a lot about Southwest Airlines problems recently, an airline that many people swear by. Didn't the inspectors use checklists in their case?
Well, they should have. And I think we still don't know what went wrong there. But what we do know is often these errors, they're not just one issue. There's something that goes way back, what we call the latent errors, that lead up to the active error. And that's what they're going to have to find out. They're going to have to look at history and see what led up to this.
And you say that all aviation accidents, or almost all, can be traced to human error. If you build a system around eliminating error, you're set to fail then.
That's right, because human beings are flawed. And as much as we want our pilots and our doctors and those people who run nuclear reactors to be perfect, they can't be. So we have to build as many systems to prevent error and address them as possible.
What are crew research management courses?
This was developed to deal with aviation, and it was a way to look at the human factors of pilots. Safety used to be focused on technology. How do we make things technologically better? Crew resource management is a way of getting crews to work together better through communication to address issues like overwork, fatigue, and stress.
And you say that, as Atul Gawande points out, if doctors on a surgical team, or all the members of a surgical team, the nurses, the doctors, whatever, know each other's names, that actually decreases the incidence of errors?
That's right. I think it was Dr. Gawande who said at first he didn't understand the point of this. Why are we introducing ourselves? It's a waste of time. But they found they actually work together better. Small groups of people work together better when they know each other's names.
A listener says, I always appreciate learning from the mistakes of others rather than myself.
Someone, I think there's a quote to that effect that it said, learn from other errors because you won't have all the time in your life to make your own errors. And I think that's true. And we can do that to a certain point, but we have to learn from our own errors. There's no getting around it.
How much of this is actual physical? Does dopamine play a part in how we process
errors? Yes, it turns out that dopamine does play a role in that, and that people with Parkinson's, for example, that affects dopamines, tend to learn better from negative reinforcement, oddly enough. But when they've given medication to raise the dopamine, they start learning better from positive reinforcement.
There's also the matter of apologies. If you do make a mistake, there are sometimes somebody will give you an apology and you feel like, well, they're just saying this is a matter just to shut me up. But you say there are three components of an effective apology.
That's right. It's acknowledging it, expressing regret for whatever you did to injure the party, and taking accountability and, if possible, fixing it. And I think too many public apologies we've seen lately have been what most people cynically see as PR spins, not really any kind of real apology. And I think that creeps down even to our personal lives.
Well, we have politicians who make mistakes and then say, well, the press is picking on me because I'm a conservative or I'm a liberal, instead of saying, well, you know, I said something stupid.
I think that's right. And I think someone I interviewed said this shouldn't be a demand for forgiveness. It should be a hope for forgiveness. And too many of these apologies are sort of, I've said I'm sorry, now forgive me.
But a really sincere apology can also be good for the person who made the mistake.
You're right. And we've discovered this with doctors. Doctors have an incredibly hard time acknowledging errors, mistakes, or adverse errors, as they call them, because for all sorts of reasons. And a large part of that is medical malpractice. But what's been discovered, interestingly enough, when doctors and patients are allowed to talk after an alleged error, and when an apology is given, as if necessary, malpractice suits actually go down.
Are people who have caused accidents or who have made a mistake, doctors who have made a mistake, advised by their lawyers not to apologize to avoid admitting guilt?
Well, often they're told to what's called deny and defend. But almost every state now has what's called an I'm sorry law, where it's true. It's hard to believe we've had to legislate this now, but we have, where doctors, and in some cases even people who've had traffic accidents, are allowed to say certain ways of saying I'm sorry, which doesn't admit fault.
You discussed the contrast between Duke Corporation's responses to deadly accidents, the Tylenol poisoning incident in the 1980s, and the recent recall of millions of Toyota cars.
Yes. Well, Tylenol was, even though it has been a while ago, it's used as a classic example of a company that immediately stepped up, immediately owned up, even though no one knew exactly what was happening with the poisoning, immediately recalled, did not hedge in any way. People had said after that Tylenol would be dead, and in fact, most of us still use it. Toyota hedged and hedged, and it's still not exactly clear, but they didn't come out, and it caused people to just believe they were covering something up.
And we're seeing the same thing now in Japan with TEPCO.
Exactly.
People no longer believe anything that TEPCO says, even if they're being totally accurate. BP earlier.
I think people...
How come they haven't learned from this?
I think there's always I think for financial reasons and others, there's always the motive to cover up or at least not to come forward with the full truth, and people sense that.
Can we blame the fact that men tend to be the ones involved in this? Because women apologize more than men, don't they?
They do. Studies have shown you're going to get me in trouble. People, this is the place people seem to take the most issue with gender differences, is that women do tend to apologize more. I mean, men are in more prominent positions to begin with for the most part. So that's why we see them more public apologies. Women tend to agonize over their mistakes more, tend to. I know it's not universal. Men tend to blame others and point their finger outward.
Well, my favorite apology ever was by John Updike when I caught him on something. He said, "You're right, I'll never do it again."
That's pretty good.
That shut me up.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
What about people who think that no matter what they do is going to be a mistake, like people who have obsessive compulsive disorder?
I mean, I think
that... Is that related in any way?
I mean, it's far out on the spectrum. And I think most of those who suffer from obsessive compulsive disorder, that is people who feel that everything is a mistake. They fear that they haven't turned off the gas. Or they keep checking. But down on the continuum, and it's not obsessive compulsive, is people who are perfectionists.
A listener left this comment on our show page. My first marriage was a great mistake, but were it not for those years of difficult and often ugly emotional work, I wouldn't be capable of the healthy relationship I have now. One of your colleagues at the New York Times told me actually third marriages are the best, because the first one you blame the spouse. The second one you realize that you played a major role in the problems. And then the third one is the one that where you have learned from
your
mistakes.
So how do we count for Elizabeth Taylor?
Well, there are always exceptions. Mickey Rooney, maybe he was just a grumpy guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Alina Tugin has written a book called Better by Mistake, The Unexpected Benefits of Being Wrong. Do you think that this excuses you for any future mistakes that you might make in your columns?
No, and I know you know that's not true. I feel I'm very conscientious. But I do want to say, I think some people, and I did write a column on perfectionism and got a response where someone said, this is so misguided. You're just letting people off the hook. They can make mistakes right and left. This is not about that. We don't embrace people who make mistakes over and over. This is not about that at all.
Well, I've learned in doing this show that if I don't forgive myself for my mistakes, that I just obsess over them and then I can't do the rest of the show. But the listeners are a lot less forgiving.
That's my readers are a lot less forgiving. But I'm learning to try to forgive myself and not obsess for exactly the reasons you said.
Alina Tugin of the New York Times, Better by Mistake is her book. It is published by Riverhead. And thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much.